It's a Wednesday, and the program is set to commence. Yours truly, Bob McCowan, along with John Shannon.
Robert.
From afar. We are going to discuss footy today.
What?
Yeah, exactly. This may be the first time that I've actually done a show. I mean, I've done a few shows where we've talked about soccer, but not as an item, as a lead, as a the big news. But it is the big news. And so we're going to get to that. Our friend James Sherman will join us in a little bit.
We better talk about it quick because it's changing every hour.
It sure is. And we'll get to that too. I did want to take a couple minutes off the top to address the woes of the Toronto Maple Leafs, who have now dropped five straight games, one of which was a tie, so they got a point for that.
They got two points, actually, that way, Bob.
So. I'm sorry? They got another tie they lost in overtime?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But they have not won in five.
Correct.
And this is the kind of stumble that you would not expect from a team that is supposed to be as good as the Toronto Maple Leafs, which raises the question in my mind, have people, and maybe including you and I, me getting sucked along, overrated this team? Is this still a flawed team, or is this nothing more than about goaltending?
Well, wouldn't that be the ultimate flaw in the end? I mean, let's be honest. Freddie Anderson going down the way he went down and now on long-term injured reserve. Michael Hutchinson, who has, a typical journeyman's resume. David Riddick, Jack Campbell. Right now, if you looked at this roster and looked at instability, you'd really have to look at the goaltending position, because this team can still score, skate. It can do lots of stuff with the defensemen and the forwards, but you have to stop the puck.
Well, I get that, but you're coming off a six-goal game, one of which was in the empty basket. But this team really hasn't scored enough. This is supposed to be an offensive juggernaut, and you've really got one guy who is scoring at an extraordinary level, and we know who that is. It's Matthews. Mm-hmm. But I could argue with you that you're not getting enough contribution from secondary pieces offensively. And this has sort of turned into a one-line offensive machine. And even the second line is not scoring with enough regularity, in my opinion. Because you could have made the argument a year ago that the second line was virtually as good as the first line.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because prior to the five games, which coincided with the trade deadline as well, Bob, the second line, which was William Nylander, John Tavares, and Alex Galchenyuk, was playing as good as that first line. And in fact, I would tell you that John Tavares was playing his best hockey as a member of the Maple Leafs because of the chemistry he had with the other two guys. The one thing that jumps out at me right now is the guy that you think is scoring all the goals, and that's Auston Matthews. I don't think Matthews is 100%. I think that wrist issue is still bothering him. Lots of people made light of it that prior to the deadline, he didn't play on a Thursday night. He confided in the media on the Monday or Tuesday that he took the night off because his wrist was bothering him. And Bob, as a pro, former pro golfer, you know that if in a sport like hockey, sport like golf, if your wrists are bothering you, they don't heal quickly.
You're missing the point.
That's one of the problems.
I know, but you're missing the point. I'm not here to blame Matthews. Matthews is playing very well.
I'm not blaming him. I'm stating a reality.
But I don't think that changes. If he's 100%, I don't think the drop-off is significant. I think this team might not be as good as the sum of its parts.
Well, but let me ask you this. Has Joe Thornton hit the wall?
He has contributed very little.
Has Jason Spezza slowed down a bit?
Yes.
Where is Wayne Simmonds in all of this?
Negligible.
So You know, the troops are on the way in a small sense. Nick Foligno will fly on today, Wednesday, via private plane to Winnipeg to join the club. Whether he plays Thursday night in Winnipeg is still up for debate. Mind you, with Zach Hyman out of the lineup, maybe it does make sense for Foligno to be plugged into that first line with Matthews and Marner. Zach Bogosian took an awful spill yesterday. I'd be shocked if he's ready to play in Winnipeg by Thursday. So that means, does that mean Ben Hutton, who is coming out of quarantine, they acquired from Anaheim, does that mean he joins the lineup? There's no question, Bob, your initial premise about is this team flawed? I think one person knew that from the beginning, and that's Kyle Dubas. And I think that's why he was so active at the trade deadline, is because he saw from a very, very close distance, he saw some of those flaws and is trying to shore up those flaws.
Well, the notion that the Toronto Maple Leafs are legitimately in the Stanley Cup championship hunt does not look very realistic at this moment. And I know that can change. That can change overnight.
You know, right now, if you told me that of the three quality teams, the best teams in Canada, Edmonton, Winnipeg, or Toronto, any three of them came out of the second round and played in the semifinals, it wouldn't surprise me. There's nothing that says, I mean, this is an on any given day scenario. Edmonton could beat Toronto. Toronto could beat Edmonton. Both of them can beat Winnipeg, and Winnipeg can beat either team. Well, and to be able to survive the first two rounds in Canada will be an unbelievable challenge, because it's going to be physical, brutal hockey.
I get that, but the notion that the Toronto Maple Leafs or all three of these teams might be as good as Vegas, Colorado, Tampa, Florida, mm-hmm. Who knows who else, might not be true. I don't think really good teams lose five in a row. And injuries, yes, are a part of it. But we don't know when Anderson is coming back. We aren't even 100% sure Anderson is coming back. And even if he does, he has demonstrated since he came to the Maple Leafs is that he is not as good a playoff goaltender as he is a regular season goaltender.
No, so, he is skating. He is skating. But here's the thing. This is not necessarily about his health more than it is about, you know, cap management. I'm not sure he can come back before the end of the season because
of the cap situation.
The cap situation.
And then I what? Mean, are I, you going to put him in the playoffs with having not played for 2 months?
That's a great question. Right now, the answer is I wouldn't do that. I would hope that Jack Campbell, who let's face it, is fragile after going 11 straight wins, has three straight losses, and is, you know, publicly announcing that he's got some doubts about his game, which is not really very healthy for a goaltender.
Yesterday morning, it looked like the soccer world was going to get turned upside down. Now it appears it's back to right side up. But there are all kinds of issues regarding this apparently failed concept of a Super League. And nobody better to talk about it than our friend James Sharman, who will join us momentarily when the program continues after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon on the program, and our guest today needs no introduction. If you watched Primetime Sports, if you watched Sportsnet for numerous years, he was our soccer guy, and James Sharman joins us now. Sharman, you look beautiful. Everything okay?
Everything's great. Thanks, fellas. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to this.
Well, this concept of a Super League kind of, well, you know me, Sharman.
You're gonna talk about the Super League before you're gonna talk about meat pies?
We're gonna get to the meat pies later.
Okay. I'm a little peckish.
Yeah, I know you are. That's not a big surprise.
We can help you out, John.
Every day, every minute occurrence with you, Shannon.
Okay, go ahead with the Super League.
So from my perspective, this idea just kind of fell out of the sky. No anticipation it was coming. It just boom. Did you know? Was this had this been talked about for some extended period of time?
Yeah, you know what, guys? I've been covering this sport, obviously, for about 2 decades. It's always been in the background, on the back burner. It's been used in the past as a threat for leverage for these clubs to get more power, more money from UEFA. So, you know, as shocking as it was when it dropped on Sunday, it wasn't that surprising if you look back in the previous number of years. Now, it's gathered steam in the last year or so, but no one expected it to come out on Sunday when it did, not even the players, not even the managers of the club. So in that regard, it was shocking. But overall, I mean, this has been something that the big boys who are always looking for, you know, a better way to create revenues has always been there, and it's been threatened in the past.
The list of clubs initially involved. Now, there were a dozen, correct?
Yeah, 12 clubs, 3 to be named later.
So they were going to go to 15.
Why? 20 in all. The plan was, the carrot they offered the rest of the football world was, we'll give you 5 spots a year if you qualify for it. But the 15 foundation members would be guaranteed a position in that tournament.
And the concept behind, I guess we should mention the clubs. 6 English clubs, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal, Man City, Man U, and Liverpool. And then Juventus, Real Madrid, AC Milan, Barcelona, Atletico Madrid, and Inter Milan were the 12. Not shockingly, you could make the argument that, I don't know whether these are the 12 richest clubs in the world, but they're in the top, 15?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say they are the richest clubs, with the exception of Paris Saint-Germain and Bayern Munich, who were conspicuous in their silence. I think waiting to see what the reaction might be. But those two clubs and the previous 12 you mentioned there, for sure, the biggest, the richest, and the most affluent in world football.
And we should note now that at least for sure, the 6 premier teams have opted out already.
There's 3 teams left now, John. Right now, as we record this, there's 3 teams left for a little mini league. So I believe it's Real Madrid and their president, Florentino Perez, was the president of this league. Juventus, Andrea Agnelli, their chairman, was really the driving force behind this. And I believe Barcelona are still there, but they're all going to drop out momentarily.
Well, so let me ask you this, though. The thing that I looked at, particularly with the British teams, was a lot of American ownership.
Yep.
You know, the Glazer family, the Cronkies, John Henry out of Boston. What do you think that what factor was in all of this?
Massive. The driving force, you know, I mentioned Agnelli at Juventus, owned by Americans, and it was John Henry at Liverpool. It was the Glazers. The American ownership was a driving force. They want cost certainty. They want the franchise model, you know, of North American sports, which works, you know, very well over here, but that's not the sporting culture beyond these borders. So if they thought they could come in here and guarantee cost certainty, increase their revenues, they wouldn't have to answer to the mighty UEFA or FIFA, do it their own way, but they really just misjudged the room. Simple as that. That they didn't know what they were, you know, going to come up against. And that was 100 years of history of very opinionated football people.
For the purpose of clarity, if they formed this Super League, what were they going to opt out of?
So essentially, they would replace the Champions League, which is governed by UEFA. Now, the way it was communicated was they could still play in the domestic leagues. That would be okay. This would be a midweek tournament. So basically, it's replacing the Champions League, which makes them lots of money, but nothing like this. And of course, you have to qualify for the Champions League each year. Top 4 teams qualify. So, you know, you can't guarantee each year you're going to make it. So that was the one. And then, you know, UEFA came out very early on and said, listen, if this goes ahead, we will ban all those players, all those teams from all our competitions, which includes European Championships, includes potentially World Cups as well. So they came out guns a-blazing when UEFA found out about this. But that was essentially it. The Champions League, the biggest moneymaker in world sport, I am pretty sure world sport was going to be the victim here, as well as all the other teams that rely on these big names, these big teams, to generate revenues for their leagues.
So the maybe the most intriguing part of this, over the last 24 hours or more than that, 48 hours, I guess, since we heard about this and started to digest it, was the reaction of many fans of teams that were proposing to go into this. Mm-hmm. And I understand if I'm at some team, some British, Italian, Spanish team that rarely makes it to the top echelon, that is undersized, is poor by comparison, really only is flipping a coin at the beginning of a season and hoping that that, you know, rarity of getting near the top will take place. If I'm one of those teams, of course I don't like this idea. I don't like the idea of the rich getting richer. But you saw a lot. We saw a lot of the fans of Chelsea and Arsenal and the other teams that were going to go in.
Yeah, exactly.
Objecting to this. I find this extraordinary and puzzling. I don't understand why. If you're a fan, don't you want your side to play against the other biggest sides in the world?
Well, you think so, right? But it is fascinating, because that was, I guess, what they were banking on. Fans want to see Real Madrid play Juventus every other week, as opposed to, you know, Man U against Stoke or West Bromwich Albion, right?
With due respect, exactly.
Yeah. But I think what they misjudged was the deep love of the football pyramid and how you have that opportunity. Even I'm a Liverpool fan, for example, but I love the fact that any team in English football has the potential, it probably wouldn't happen, but have the potential to rise to become elite and become the best. That romanticism in British sports.
But it's not real. You acknowledge.
No, but every now and again, you'll get that, you know, story. Well, sure. A Leicester, for example. Now, they're not right, tiny. Sure. They're a pretty good-sized club, obviously, right? They can win it. It's very rare. You're right. It is really a closed shop. But I think from a financial standpoint, this tournament means far more travel for the fans. It means obviously far greater ticket prices eventually, TV deals, you know. So in the end, the fan would be paying for this. Simple as that. And I think they realized that.
I'll tell you what, though. The lore of relegation and the lore of being elevated, that's part of the magic of the game.
100% it is. Yeah.
And traditional fans, the guy that goes to the pub at noon for the 3 o'clock game, this is a lifestyle. This is not just a sport. This is a lifestyle.
It is. And as much as it's perhaps the most tribal of sports, you love your team, as much as that, they also love the sport itself. You know, that a Man U fan won't just watch Man United. They're going to watch Stoke in a relegation battle against, you know, Brighton. You know, they want to watch that because every game is meaningful or close to meaningful throughout the entire season. So I think, and part of it, let's be honest, part of it is a distrust of billionaires, right? This is Europe, this is UK in particular. They don't like people who are successful. They don't trust them. So they want to hammer them. Any opportunity to come down and hammer them, there you are. United fans have despised their ownership for years, the Glazers. They're quiet. They're anonymous. They've used it as their own personal cash box. They've despised them. Now they've got a real reason to jump on them. So I think that's part of what it was as well.
Well, I mean, all of the American owners have never been accepted. I mean, Bob, your old buddy, George Gillette, how long did he last?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, actually, because John Henry of Fenway Sports Group, Boston Red Sox, owns Liverpool, bought it from Hicks and Gillette in 2010 for £300 million, I think it was, pounds. It's now worth £3 billion, right? So the fans have actually really embraced John Henry because he brought in Jurgen Klopp. He brought in some you know, very well-known figures from Liverpool within the club itself. He fixed a stand, built a new training ground. They loved him until Sunday. And then Sunday hits and bam, nope, sorry, we've turned on you, mate. How dare you, you know, try and buy our sport? And that's the mentality.
Hey, James, how much background had been done by these guys? When you talk about where the revenue is coming from, by far the biggest number would have come from television. Do you think that they had a TV deal? Was there a TV deal in place? Had they done that?
It's funny because the DAZNs and the Sky Sports really straight away distance themselves from this whole thing, saying we are yet to discuss this because they knew what would happen. I'm sure there's conversations with the streaming companies, the Netflixes of the world, Amazons. That makes more sense to me. They had to make money somehow, right? Now, I know JP Morgan was the bank that is financing this off the top. I'm just completely stunned that they crumbled so quickly and that they are surprised by this. These are not stupid men, not stupid people. These are successful, intelligent human beings who completely misread the room entirely. So from a TV standpoint, I'm not surprised that the various networks kept quiet, because although I'm sure there were conversations, they don't want to be tarnished with this either.
Let's be clear. JP Morgan finances most sports in most countries on every continent. Right. JP Morgan has its tentacles everywhere in professional sports.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talked, James, about your shock, maybe not shock, but at least surprise that these guys didn't read the room. The shocking thing to me is that it's not shocking that one guy, even two, might misread the atmosphere, but that a dozen collectively were so fragile in their commitment that it took literally minutes for them to reverse a decision that they'd already made. It puzzles me to the point of wondering whether there is a phase two to this. I'm not sure they're that dumb. I can't believe they would make this critical a mistake and then roll over on their stomachs the minute there was any opposition to it, and do so collectively. It's like they knew this was going to happen and they planned this, and there is something to come next. But what do you think?
The PR is so negative. I mean, these guys are thick-skinned, right? They can now hide away in their mansions, in their office buildings, and in the States, wherever it's going to be, in Abu Dhabi, you know, not in England, that's for sure. They can hide from this now, for sure. You're right. Now, I do wonder, I mean, it's been used in the past, this threat as leverage with UEFA, right? There's been big reforms announced this week to the Champions League, which will help these clubs. I'm a bit like you. I do wonder if UEFA got in their ear, or perhaps it was planned this way, that, listen, we're going to open up the Champions League further. We're going to guarantee you spots eventually. And this maybe, you know, the negotiations came to a point where they got to play hardball. And for some bad PR, they'll suck it up if it means that in 2024-25, the next cycle of European football, maybe they will get more than they hoped for in the past. So it's definitely possible. But I just look at the outrage against these clubs right now, these owners. I mean, I don't think they foresaw it being quite this much of a backlash.
So now, do you expect these teams to get sanctions?
I would be surprised, honestly. I think at this point, you know, the Premier League need them. Simple as that. They're the driving commercial forces for the Serie A, for La Liga especially, and the Premier League. So I think they might get a slap on the wrist. But the fact that they pulled out now, and now, you know, the statements are coming out. John Henry had a heartfelt apology last night saying, we made a mistake. It's all on me. I'm sorry. I think that the world football will hope it just goes away now. Because prior to that, UEFA were, you know, threatening the worst of the worst. And that is, we're banning everyone from every competition. No World Cups anymore. No Euros. And that, I think, empowered the players too. And as much as the fans were a big part of this, I think that the players and the coaches got together and finally show some solidarity, which, you know, they haven't really shown in the past, and said, we're not going to take it, we don't like it, and we're going to refuse to play in it.
So you wouldn't see the 12 get sanctions for Champions League at all?
I can't see it. They need them. Simple as that. Oh. You know, and I'm sure when they, this wasn't, I'm sure when they backed down, it didn't surprise UEFA. Seferin, that their president, was so, he was just beside himself, you know, impassioned comments and threats saying, if you don't come back and give this up, we will do this. Well, they did give it up. They did collapse. So I guess they acquiesced to his wishes.
You know, the interesting thing for me is that we've all, maybe more from those of us on the outside that don't know as much, we all know the corruption that has existed in the game at so many levels with FIFA, maybe to a lesser extent with UEFA at a point. And there might have been a bubble saying, hey, they finally got their due. The big boys have finally pushed back. But in the end, the governing bodies maintained their power. And now, might I suggest, are even more emboldened to maintain their power?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, I mean, this thing, like I said, has been rumored for so many years. It was always there as a possibility to take down UEFA and FIFA. Well, they tried it and they failed, didn't they? So I think it probably has emboldened UEFA. It's a fascinating situation. You know, what I found really interesting was, you know, Man City, owned by Middle Eastern, trillionaires, PSG in particular, owned by Qatari trillionaires, and they're the World Cup in next year, right? So PSG very quiet on the sidelines, not getting involved in this. So they are politicizing it, I think, from day one as well. There's so many different layers to this, but at this point, UEFA is feeling pretty good about themselves, but they shouldn't come out as being the knight in shining armor here. This is UEFA, you're right. They've got a history, right? They're not great guys either. As much as they're a lot cleaner now than perhaps they once were, there's, let's just take a bit of a breath here and say, listen, there's more than just 12 bad guys here. You know, right. This is an environment created by this football machine.
The Bundesliga looks okay out of this.
They do, yeah. Bayern Munich, they're like saying, thank God for that, right? At the same time, it's more difficult for them, right? Because German clubs, there's law in the country that they must be owned 51% of each club by fans. Right. So they get a spot at the table. They couldn't commit to the Champions League, Super League, for example, without putting it through by the fans first, which is probably why they sat very quiet. And that might be the legacy from this. You know, I know Boris Johnson, Great Britain's famous leader, infamous leader.
I was going to mention him.
He's hinted that maybe that's a model that English football should look at, getting fans more involved, 51% of each club owned by fans. So maybe that's what comes out of this.
Well, the British Prime Minister was very vocal in responding to this notion of a Super League and basically threatened them with whatever he can threaten them with. And I find that so interesting because I can't imagine the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Canada jumping in and saying something about Major League Baseball or the National Hockey League in a sort of a comparable situation. John's going to try and disagree with me.
Well, I mean, you're seeing Republican senators push back at Major League Baseball's antitrust. You know, they will be involved. They will get involved if they think it will help them politically. And, you know, if four NHL teams left Canada, I guarantee you that Justin Trudeau would be involved and say, we've got an issue. You know, we have to fix it.
James, is that your assessment of Johnson's comments and him jumping in right away? Would you think it was politically motivated?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, listen, he's looking quite good right now for once, right? You know, they've dealt with COVID relatively well. They're opening up. Everyone's happy. Everyone's smiling there right now. Great chances in PR now to appease the proletariat, right? All those football fans. Absolutely.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I mean, at the same time, you know, football is like hockey here, but maybe perhaps even more so. It's very much the cultural fabric of the country, right? But listen, this is football's been sold out for at least 30 years, right? Since the Premier League started anyway. And it's been pretty quiet until then. But there's a lot of issues with the game in England, but this was definitely a chance for him to come out and say, hey, I got your back, people. You know, don't worry, Uncle Boris will take care of you.
Let's take a break. We're going to come back. James Sharman is with us. We're going to talk about his pie company, but we're also going to... Yeah. I've got a few other things to say on the sport, and nobody better to talk to than Mr. Sharman. We'll take a quick break. Back after these messages. Yours truly, Bob McCowan, along with John Shannon and James Sharman, our favorite soccer guy. A whole bunch of things, maybe in bullet form. How's soccer in North America doing?
Hold on. We're not talking about pies yet.
Not yet.
Thanks, John.
What is that? I'm starved.
You're not going to, we can talk about it. You won't be able to eat it. You know, not this moment. I got news for you.
I tell you what, I when we invited James on, I said, you know, we can talk pies and then maybe a bit of soccer, not soccer and a bit of pies.
Well, with due respect, this is the way we're going to do it.
Because you love the sport so much.
Well, you know me. North American soccer has been around a long time now. We think of it still in some ways as a new kind of entity, but hell, the effort to integrate the North American population to the sport has existed since the 1960s, really. So we're talking 60 years plus. How are they doing? How is North American soccer, or is it fair to even evaluate it given the pandemic?
Yeah, it's difficult, obviously. From a footballing standpoint, a quality standpoint, it's looking really great. MLS is improving all the time. There's more and more North American players playing for big clubs overseas. You know, obviously we have our own Alfonso Davis, great story, winning trophies at one of the biggest clubs in world football. Yes, so that in that regard, really, really well. As far as, you know, the following, I have my worries. You know, I mean, when the World Cup was announced a few years ago now for 2026, we thought, wow, we're in for this great wave of soccer in this country. And then DAZN comes along, starts stealing rights away from the traditional broadcasters. Mm-hmm. Fewer eyeballs are now watching it, I think. Even though, you know, DAZN keep those numbers pretty quiet, I can't imagine them being greater than they were when TSN and Sportsnet broadcast the games. So in that regard, it's a concern. I think the game's growing. MLS, like I said before, you know, the numbers are up and down there. They're not that consistent, but franchise fees keep going up through the roof. So it's still a big picture situation. It's doing well. We need a World Cup here. It's going to be a big game breaker, I think. But overall, you know, at times it does plateau, I think, a little bit.
I think that's well said about DAZN, and it's worth discussing, because I believe that there are many casual soccer fans in North America, far more casual soccer fans than probably per capita anywhere else in the world. As you said earlier, people elsewhere are committed to their home side, the team they support. They'll watch them all the time, and then they'll watch other games as well. Here, it's a little more loosey-goosey. And with Sportsnet, TSN, ESPN carrying games, NBC has a few, you get the opportunity as a casual fan to sample. And that is now gone. And those people are not going to commit to X dollars to watch DAZN. So all you're doing is preaching to the already converted with that. And I think it hurts the growth potential of the sport in North America. Agree or not?
I agree 100%. Yeah, absolutely. You know, those casual fans who would be just perusing the channels on a Saturday morning and catching a Premier League game with a brand they know, Manchester United, a Chelsea. I don't know much about these players, but I know that brand. They're going to watch it, right? And now you can't get it unless you're paying your $20 a month for DAZN. So you're really appeasing the fans that are there already. What about the future fans? You know, which takes us back to that Super League thing, right? I mean, they didn't care about the legacy fans. They cared about the fans over the next 23 years of this deal. How can they get them? Well, right now in North America, where are those fans? You know, watching MLS, sure, but let's be honest. MLS is great and it's growing in some regards, but people still want to see the best of the best. And you're not finding that in MLS right now. You find that in the Premier League, in the Serie A, in La Liga. So it's very difficult. So as far as overall growth, I think you're right. I think it's probably stagnated since DAZN came aboard.
Yeah, the interesting thing about MLS is, I think that they have found a niche. They aren't part of the big four, but there is a niche. When you think of them going to Austin, Texas for an expansion team, we're not talking a major market. We're talking a market that has a little bit of soccer savvy to it, and they've gone to that secondary level of at times. And had relative success, and you know, it's a different business model than we're used to, but it seems to be working for them.
Yeah, you're right, and you know, you're seeing franchise fees, you know, grow every year. They're demanding soccer specific stadiums, so visually it's very appealing compared to when MLS first started out. You can remember the games, right, with the football markings in the field. Terrible visually. It's come a long way from there. So they're smart, and they've been growing slowly. Very slowly. And that's been what's really interesting. But I think 27 teams now in MLS? That's quite a lot.
Pretty close, yeah.
Well, I'm intrigued as a soccer fan. I mean, I will tell you my perception of it. It is obvious to me when I watch an MLS game, the inferiority of the quality of play by comparison to any of the big leagues, certainly the Premiership. To watch a Premiership game right after you watch an MLS game is like night and day. How do you, as a lifelong soccer guy and a Brit on top of that, how do you watch MLS soccer? Don't you look, can you do anything but look down your nose at it?
Hey, I watch hours of snooker every week, Bob. So, hey, I'll watch anything.
Well, but I don't think you watch bad snooker players.
That's a good point. Yeah, valid point.
Well, no, let's talk about darts. You got to watch darts too, Jake. Well, you got the darts.
You know,
going to
watch it live, you know, is a great experience. Now, I wish it was over here because darts is fantastic. Mm. It really is. But you know what, Bob? I mean, I know what you're saying. I don't think the gap is quite as great as perhaps you're suggesting there. Obviously, Premier League, Serie A, that's the elite. And yes, you know, there is a difference. But the league championship in England, for example, gets good TV numbers, great fan support. That's similar to MLS. There's still some very good players coming through here. I think it's changed. You're not seeing so many washed up European stars here now who are clearly over the hill. They're targeting younger players, a lot from Central and South America. It's becoming a real stepping stone, more so than ever before, for that next step, which is to top leagues in Europe. So I think in that regard, the quality has definitely improved. But you're right, it's not quite the same, but it's ours. You know, we have ownership of this now, finally. Right. We can actually start building a soccer culture around MLS, around CPL, NESL. You can start doing that, which is a change and it's refreshing.
The interesting thing is that I hear what Bob is saying, and I can understand that. So much of what makes particularly soccer in the UK so much fun to watch is presentation. It's not the game. It's presentation.
Yeah.
It's style. It's ambient noise. It's camera angles. It's, you know, the stands. It's the singing. It's the whole event. You go to Seattle, you go to Portland, Vancouver, even in Toronto, you do hear the crowd sing, but it's different. It's different. It's a different style. And we fall in love with the romance of the game when we watch the Premier League, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is more manufactured here. And certainly at first, right. I think now look at TFC Vancouver, been around a while, right? You know, I think the fans now are becoming far more sophisticated. They are proper football fans, but at first, yes, it was manufactured. It seemed a little bit plastic, but what else could they really do? But the Premier League is the Premier League, you know. I mean, this why it's the most successful sports league arguably in the world, right? You have that fervent fan support, which honestly isn't always great. I mean, it looks great on TV. If you go to a Premier League game, it's not always that great in there. Manchester United have a reputation of being the Toronto Maple Leafs of professional soccer, right? Big old.
No, they win a little more. They win a little more.
Well, that is certainly true. But they've matched experience. You know, a lot of sports consumers there, not so much fans. You go to the proper football club, so to speak, and it's still very edgy. You know, I know North American sports gets criticized a lot for the fan experience compared to in Europe, the way it should be. It's a much more enjoyable experience here because you're not threatened. You won't get your head punched in. You won't get, you know, in this the exception of some you know, places in the States, in the NFL perhaps, you won't be, you know, in too much trouble in the stands if you cheer for the wrong team. The fans are mixed. So, you know, I always argue that point when people say it's much better experience over there. It is, and it's more passionate, sure, but it's not always more enjoyable.
Well, to John's point about singing, for decades, Jerry Lewis used to do a Labor Day telethon on television. And at the end of the telethon, he would sing, "You'll Never Walk Alone," and you'd break into tears and whatever. If I never see Liverpool fans sing that very same song again, I'll be fine with it. And I know you're a Liverpudlian, but
hey, come on now, Bobby. It's
manufactured homerism that I'm not buying into.
Hey, you got to sit in the cup in Anfield on a big match day. It's incredible. I mean, you get goosebumps. I'm as jaded as any fan, but that is pretty special, let me tell you. And it's been a number of years now. It's been a long time now. I like having anthems for various clubs, which really mean nothing. Look at West Ham. I'm forever blowing bubbles. What the hell is that, right?
I've got no idea.
No, Blue Moon at Man City. I think more North American sports needs their anthems, quite frankly.
Agreed.
Pick a song.
Okay. Can we talk about pies now?
Yeah, we can. We got a couple minutes here. We're at that point.
So what the heck? You're in the meat pie business. You have a store for a while on the Danforth.
You know what? Once upon a time, if you told me I'd be on, would have been on TV, I would have laughed in your face, said no chance. And once upon a time, you told me I had a meat pie company, I'd say you're crazy. Why would I be doing that? But yeah, we've been doing it for about 4 years now, one way or the other. And the last year, we've actually finally got our stores and our e-commerce site functioning for a subscription service. And it's been great. It's been a ton of fun, a big learning curve for my wife and myself. And I'm in the meat pie business. Who knew?
So what's
whose recipe?
Forget the recipe. What's the history? How do you, why meat pies?
Well, you know what? Honestly, I saw the writing on the wall in the media world a few years ago now, especially with soccer, the way it was going, and thought, man, at some point, I'm probably going to lose my job. I need a plan B here. So that kind of really, you know, pushed me to find something. My wife's the entrepreneur. She's the one with the guts, and she wanted a product business for years and years and years. So
understand.
Long story short, my mother-in-law came to stay with us for a few weeks, which turned into a few months, which I'll write a book on one day. Anyway, she was a big cook. She cooked pies. She sold them at farmers markets in Alberta. We just took them with her thinking, you know what? There's no good pies around here. I grew up in good pies. Can't find good pies. So she basically taught me how to cook pies, and we took it from there. Simple as that, from a farmer's market to the website and now to a couple of stores. And it's been, like I said, we didn't expect the growth to be this quick, but it's very exciting.
And just for clarity, we are talking exclusively like dinner pies, hot pies, correct?
Yep, that's right. Mainly savory. We have got some sweet options too, but basically they're frozen pies. We deliver to your house through either a subscription service or a la carte. Right now, we're across the GTA into York. We have plans to be going province-wide in the next few months.
What's the website?
Shamansproper.ca. Shamansproper.ca. Shamansproper pies. And it's great. You know, it allows me to kind of be a little bit picky with potential media opportunities as I stare at my phone. you know how that feels, right? But it's great. I really, really thoroughly enjoy it, and I certainly have ambitions to get back in the media world at some point, but in the meantime, this is great.
Fantastic.
I must ask, what's your favorite pie, or does it change?
Okay, so you know, it's a cliche, right? It's a football related. It's called the chicken balti. It's a chicken curry pie, which is the biggest selling food at British soccer stadiums. Has been for years now, and it's a pie in a pint. That's what you do. And chicken balti is very, very good.
How many times have you gone to a pub and said, just give me a pie and a pint?
Pie and a pint, really? Exactly, that's right?
The last time my son and I, we spent a couple summers back, we spent a long time just walking through London for 17, 18 days. Oh, and wow. By day three, the 2 o'clock, we're stopping for a pie and a pint.
Yep, absolutely, right? It's a way of life there. It really is. And we're trying to reinvent that here now.
So you sell single serving pies, and then you sell what I think they're called family pies?
Yeah. Family size pies, which feeds 3 to 4 people and the individuals. We just started sausage rolls as well the last couple of weeks. Pasties.
Wow. Yeah.
So you can get them hot as well at the store. We have a selection in the stores, but it's ostensibly a B2C, you know, e-commerce business.
Fantastic. We wish you continued success with it.
Thank you very much. Now, I appreciate the plug.
Yeah, well, happy to do it. Shannon was pushing the entire show to get it in early.
Yeah, well, we could have done the whole show on pies, but
next time.
The thing is, James, is that there's a lot of admiration. There's a ton of us. Bob's done it a bit, but there's a ton of us that have all these ideas, but don't have the balls to do it.
Well, my wife's a very intimidating figure. She terrifies me. So,
we thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to the next opportunity we have to bug you.
Anytime, fellas. I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much. And good
luck, James.
Cheers.
James Sharman, back to wrap it in a moment after these messages. Back to wrap it up. McCowan with Shannon. Again, our thanks to James Sharman. Now, I know you're extremely disappointed. Your efforts to solicit complimentary meat pies from Charmin was not reciprocated in the manner that you were hopeful of.
How dare you insinuate that I was looking
John,
for free
I
food?
Know you. You know, you started out by with the meat pie thing, then in the middle of the interview, the meat pie thing. And then at the end, you just went right to the meat pies. And yeah. I know, and expressing how hungry you are, I know exactly what you were fishing for. Now,
he has sausage rolls now too, Bob.
I got a little hungry myself, I must confess.
There you go. There
you go. Are you a meat pie guy?
Oh, yeah. Steak and kidney.
Oh, really? I'm a chicken pot pie guy. That's about as far as I'll go.
Well, tell you what, it's much nicer every once in a while to talk about meat pies than it is the plight of a National Hockey League team or the plight of billionaires going through a little angst for 48 hours when their fans revolt. So,
well, I confess, it was a big story. And And it is staggering to me that it ended before we could even get to it.
I think we did a pretty good job.
Well, we got to it after it ended. But I would not be surprised if there's something else in this, that these teams will wind up getting something that they want and they like out of this apparently failed experiment. But we shall see.
I'm sure there's people wondering why they didn't do some market research.
Well, maybe they did. That'll do it for us. We'll be back again tomorrow if the crick don't rise. Everybody have a good day, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.